Now we're holding on page 66 in Shabbos, beginning Hamotzi Perek Shmini. The subject of the Perek is that you have, where one of the 39 malachas is you can't carry on Shabbos. For each kind of substance, there's a minimum amount that a person rechayev midaraisa for carrying outdoors. Less than that, generally speaking, he's not going to be chayev unless you have the rare case where achshavei, where a person considers a smaller amount to be important to him personally, and then he's chayev for a lesser amount. So therefore, the end of the seventh parak and the whole eighth parak and half of the ninth parak deal with these details of different substances, what's the minimum amount of them that a person would be chayev for carrying out on Shabbos. So one of them it mentions in the Mishnah is honey. The minimum amount is what you would need to put on a sore. If you have a sore on an animal's back or what have you, you put honey on it to help it feel better. So that small amount of honey would be the amount, which is the minimum amount. So that leads the Gemara into...
Depending about the size of the sore, though.
We're talking about, the average size one or something. I mean, there was a known thing, you know, when you have, if you saddle up the animal wrong or whatever, then you're going to have a sore of a certain size. Anyway, so that brings the Gemara now into discussing a side thing of a different thing that's also good to put on a sore. So Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Kol ma shebara HaKadosh Baruch Hu bara lamai, lo bara davar echad lebatalim. Of all the things Hashem created in the world, he didn't create anything without a purpose. Everything in the world we can find a purpose for. For example, Bara Shablul Lakosis. For example, Hashem created a snail. On the face of it, what do snails accomplish for us? But it's good for a kosis, it's good for this kind of thing, for a wound or a sore like that, that you put the snail on it, and that maybe the mucus from it helps it feel better, helps it heal, whatever it is. The point is.
Slime,
whatever it is, yeah. Similarly, Barzvov Latsira. Similarly, you have a tsira, a person who was stung by a tsira, which is a hornet. So now Hashem created flies that are good. It's good for that. So you crush up a fly and put it on the sting. Marsha points out, you should go back a step. So why did Hashem create the hornets? Fine, that the Gemara is not dealing with, because obviously Hashem created creatures like that in order to be able to, people sometimes need punishments, min Hashemayim, and this is how Hashem chooses to bring the punishment. So the Gemara is not asking why hornets exist, but once hornets exist, the question is, what's the purpose of flies where they're these little weak creatures and there doesn't seem to be much use for them? The answer is they're useful for this kind of thing. Similarly, Yatush l'nachosh, similarly Hashem created mosquitoes or gnats, and those are good for a snake bite. The nachosh l'chafofis, in turn, the snake itself has, besides that, as we said, sometimes it's the vehicle through which Hashem punishes a person, but there's also that the snake itself is also sometimes a remedy, l'chafofis, where a person is suffering from chafofis, which is a type of boils, it actually says, some type of rash or boils or what have you. Another example is Hashem created spiders where they're good for a scorpion bite. Same idea. A person was stung by a scorpion. You crush a spider and put it on there. So the Gemara says, "Hey, the Ovidlei, how do you prepare that? How do you prepare that exactly? Maisi chod uchma v'chod chivra." You get one black and one white spider, the shaukile, you cook them together, the shaifile, and you rub the concoction on the sting. So the point is, in other words, again, that even though these are very weak, small creatures, nevertheless, Hashem made them, and you would think, what purpose do they have in the world? But they do have a purpose. So in this connection now, the Gemara goes on to talk about, in a similar vein, that you have five creatures that are very strong, but each of them has something that Hashem created, a tiny little creature that they're scared of. The message from it being, Maharsha says, that you should realize, for example, a person should never rely on his strength and how great he is and so forth. You shouldn't think that I'm invulnerable. You see that these are tiny little creatures that nevertheless are able to scare much creatures much larger than them. The Maharal points out also the vote is, since these are, the Gemara is going to mention such powerful creatures, an elephant, an eagle, a vyasin, and so forth, if there was nothing that they're afraid of, then they would be, only Hashem has nobody whom he can be afraid of. Therefore, they being Nivroim, Hashem had to make that there has to be something that they're afraid of. There are five fears, there are five things that uh, five powerful creatures that still there's something weaker than them that they're afraid of. Amos Cholosh al Giber, first of all, the fear that the strong has of the weak in general, that you have that a strong person sometimes may be defeated by a weaker one. And then Amos Mafgia al Ari, the fear that a lion has from the Mafgia. So Rashi describes that it's a little creature with a very loud voice. So when the lion hears this mafgia, he thinks that a much larger creature is coming to attack it and runs away. There's different other explanations what it is. The Ben Yehoyada brings that actually a mafgia is some kind of small, nimble animal with very sharp claws that jumps onto the lion's back and eventually digs into its brain, and the lion can't fight it off because it's very quick and nimble and sitting on its back. So that would be the mafgia, then, that even the lion is afraid of it. The next one, Amos Yatu shall appeal, the fear that the elephant has of the mosquito. So Rashi describes it goes into the elephant's trunk and the elephant can't get it out. Next one, Amos Smomis al Akrav, the fear that a scorpion has of a spider. The spider, Rashi describes, goes into the scorpion's ear and bothers him. And again, the scorpion can't dislodge him.
Spider goes into the scorpion's ear?
Yeah. A scorpion is much larger than a spider. So the spider, we're talking, I guess, some very small type of spider. Yeah. So it crawls into their, yeah. I mean, the truth is, once microscopes were discovered and they found all kinds of creatures that are invisible to the naked eye, eventually they found little creatures called mites, which live on, there's various kinds. Some live on people's skin, some infest various kinds of animals, and many of them actually are related to spiders. So the Gemara may mean that. The Gemara may not mean the regular kind of spider that you find spinning webs. It may mean something in that family, like those mites over there. Say what? Yeah, so why do they come to us? So we said, first of all, you can use them to heal a snake bite. That was Yakush Lenafash. Second of all, you have it scares the lion. And B'chol, I mean, we know from other places, the Gemara sometimes will use a Yakush as a means to punish a person. Famously, you have Titus, a Yakush, a gnat crawled into his nose and eventually ate up his brain, with that said, there is also a medrash, a famous medrash, where David HaMelech asks Hashem about three things that he created in the world, why they're necessary, mosquitoes, spiders, and insanity, and Hashem shows him how each time at some point in his life, he needs each one of them. Insanity is he pretended to be crazy when he was by Ochish, as Tamil with Navi Melech. A spider one time spun a web in front of a cave that David was hiding in, Shaul and his men didn't realize he's there, and a mosquito that one of the episodes over there when Shaul is chasing David, and then David and one of his men sneak into the camp to take David's to take Shaul's water bottle and his spear, so he can demonstrate afterward, look how close I was to you and I didn't harm you. And the Medrash says that Avner was sleeping over there and he shifted his legs, and David was stuck until a mosquito came and bit him, and then he drew up his leg and he was still sleeping, but like involuntarily he moved back his leg out of the way, and David was able to get out of there. So there is that also. Yeah. Continues the Gemara. The next one, Amos Nunis al Nesher. The next one is the fear that the eagle, or some say that a Nesher is a vulture, has of the Snunis. A Snunis is a little bird. Rashi translates it as a swallow. What it does is, Rashi says, it gets under the Nesher's wings and it prevents the Nesher from extending its wings fully. So like it's stuck in there and the Nesher can't dislodge it, and now it can't fly properly. And the fifth one, Amos Kilvis al Leviosan. The Leviosan is afraid of the Kilvis, which is a little type of fish. Or Rashi actually describes it over here as a little type of sheretz. Elsewhere in Shas, we find that mention where there's different mephoshim who understand whether it's a kosher or a non-kosher fish. But anyway, again, Rashi describes it goes into Leviosan's ear, or in a different place, it says it goes into the Leviosan's nose, into its nostrils, whatever. And again, it bothers it and it can't get it out of there. So Hashem created all of that. That the idea being that you should always realize that even the weaker things that Hashem made in the world, Hashem made them as available to be able to harass the stronger ones, in order that the stronger ones shouldn't think they're so great. And the same way, a person should also realize that for himself. So Omer of Yehuda Omer Rav, Maikra, where is a pasuk that expresses this idea? The pasuk says Hamavlig Shoid Al Oz. Hamavlig means that Hashem strengthens Shoid, the one who was robbed, meaning the weaker one, Al Oz, over the strong. So Hashem gives the weaker one who's already been robbed of his strength, Hashem gives him the strength to overcome the more powerful one.
That goes on the Yetzer Tov
and the Yetzer Hara. It goes on lots of things in life. Yeah. So in this connection, speaking also of how Hashem created things in the world, and why certain things work the way they do. So the Gemara gives another example of this. Rav Zeira Ashkach Rav Yehuda to have a koya pischa de mechamor. Rav Zeira one time found Rav Yehuda, who was his rebbe, was standing by the entrance of his father-in-law's house. He saw that Rabbi Yehuda was in a very good mood, in a very happy mood. And Rabbi Zeira realized that if he wants to ask Rabbi Yehuda at this point about anything in the entire cavity of the world, in all of the natural world, then it would be a good time and Rabbi Yehuda would answer him. And usually Rabbi Yehuda is partift in Torah, but now Rabbi Zeira realizes it's a good opportunity to be able to ask him about anything. Chalolei Omer, it's interesting, you know. I mean, we have in Chassidus, we have the idea of Kabbalah, that you have, you know, there's the Ein Sof, and then it was set aside to create a Cholol Makom Ponui, and there's a cabinet. So Chalolei Omer literally means like everything that's in that cavity, everything that's in that space that the Eibishter, so to speak, cleared of the Ein Sof in order to make the world possible. So Omalei, so he asks Rabbi Yehuda, my time is a mas gun beresha. Why is it when you have sheep and goats walking, you always have the goats go first, v'hadu imri, and only then the sheep? Omalei, so Rabbi Yehuda answers him, k'briyasi shel olam. It's actually the same way as when the world was first created. De beresha chashecha v'hadu nahora, first was darkness, then was light. V'choshecha p'nei sahim, and then v'yemer elokim yihir. The same way, the goats are usually dark colored. The sheep mostly are light colored. The wool of most sheep is white. So therefore, the dark goes before the light. There's some place in a sikha where the Rebbe talks about the idea that you have Rabbi Yehuda knowing, of course, as he does, about the Seder of Shtauschlus, again, about the idea that you have first Olam HaToyhu and then Olam HaTikun. So he realizes from that, as Nishtauschl, how you find it in our physical world, where you find that the goats go first. So it's not just that, it's not just like it's a nice little remez, but this is actually because it is that way in Ruchnius, therefore it descends to that way in Gashmius. And the same thing with all the other ones. Marsha gives a long explanation over here and on the next and on the other questions that all of these also represent something. They also represent something in how things are in the world with us Jews versus the nations. So the first thing he's asking is in particular the Greek kingdom, the Greeks who ruled over the Jewish people until the story of Hanukkah, they're compared, the Daniel describes them in his visions, he compares them to a goat. He sees that he visualizes them as a goat. So the question is, why in Bais Sheni, why did it have to be that there were first kings and rulers from the Greeks ruling over the Jewish people, and only then come the sheep, the Jews, where we had kings from the Hashmonaim and from the family of Urdus? And he answers Bereisha Chashecha v'Hadu Nehora, that you see already at Ma'is Bereishis, it was already that way. That you have, when it says V'Choshech Al Pnei Sahayim, the Medrash on the Pasuk says that the V'Choshech over there refers to the Greeks. The Medrash sees hints to all four Malchias in the Pesukim over there. V'Oretz HaYisayuhu V'Voyu refers to Bavel, or Toihu refers to Bavel, and Boihu refers to Paras and Madai, and Choshech refers to Yavon, and so forth. And then there was Vayhi Ur. So the same way, then that's how it came down. And Bais Sheni, that first they had to have the dark Greek Empire, which the Medrash says where they would darken the Jewish people's eyes with terrible Xeris, and only after that were they able to have the light, which is the Chashmonaim. How did they come to power? With the lights of Hanukkah. So therefore, that's how it was. Then he asks him, "My time, Ahani Michtastian, Ahani Migalian." So why is it also speaking of goats and sheep? Why is it that the sheep are covered, or their backside is covered over with a tail, with a long, thick tail? You have, in fact, when a sheep is brought as a korban, you take that tail and you offer it on the mizbeach. Ahani Migalian, whereas goats are not; they have a very short tail and their backside is exposed. So he answers, "Hani de Mechsinan Minayu Michtastian," because the sheep, we clothe ourselves with what comes from them. We take wool from them and we use it for clothing. Therefore, mechasyam, therefore, appropriately enough, Hashem made that they're covered with a tail. The ones that we don't cover ourselves with them, goat's hair is not usually used for clothing. You use it for things like sacks and other coarse material like that. Migalyan, so therefore they're exposed. The symbolism behind it, Maharsha says, continuing on the topic of the second Beis Hamikdash, the Gemara points out in Yuma that there's a big difference between Churban Bayis Rishon and Churban Bayis Sheni. Churban Bayis Rishon, it says explicitly in the Psukim what their Averis were. And the Psukim also tell us exactly how long that Golos was going to last, 70 years. As opposed to the second Beis Hamikdash, their Averis weren't so obvious. The Gemara tells us over there it was Sinas Chinam, but you don't have anything that says in Psukim so clearly. And the time when the Gula Amitis Vashlema from this Golos is going to come is also unknown to us. So he's asking him, why is that? So he's answering that's exactly it. It goes together. In the second Beis Hamikdash, it's mechasya and it's covered, and we don't know clearly what their aveda was. So therefore, their ketz, represented by the tail as like the end of things, is also hidden. As opposed to the first Beis Hamikdash, their avedas were more revealed and they were done more begolui, and therefore their end of their golus was also known. Then he asks, my time a gamla zutra gnufse, why is it that a camel has a short tail? And Rabbi Yehuda answers, "Mishum de ochal kisi," because the camel eats thorns. The camel eats thorns, and if it had a long tail, it would get tangled in the thorns. Yad Yosef brings over here on the side from the Oruch that the point is that not just that it eats thorns, but it walks in and goes among grasses and herbs and whatever that have thorns, and it would get stuck. It wouldn't be able to move at all if its tail was caught like that. The idea behind the question and the answer, Maharsha says, is that we find a big difference between how Hashem treats the goyim versus the Jewish people when it comes to punishment. The goyim, we find Hashem punishes them all at once. There comes their time, their saw is filled up, like it says in Sota, and that's it, they're goners. As opposed to the Jewish people are gradually are being punished at different times throughout the generations. The word gomel over here, specifically, he refers to Malchus Bavel. The Medrash mentions that the you have in Parashas Shemini, you have the four kinds of animals that have only one simen tara, and the Medrash associates each of them with one of the four Malchus, the camel representing Bavel. So we're saying that Bavel had and also it refers to Bavel in the sense like you have in the Pasuk Asher Yishalem as Gmuleich and Tilim, you have that happy is the one who give you what you deserve, which is related to the word Gomel. So therefore, the question is that they only had once it came their time, their goner is right away. Belshazzar made his party, and that night he's killed, and Malchus Bavel is over. As opposed to as opposed to us Jewish people, that things are more gradual. The answer is because it eats thorns. The thorns represent the Rishoyim, which is Puranus comes to the world because of them. Because of the Churban that happened, which ultimately was because of the Rishoyim, because the kingdom of Bavel did that, therefore Hashem punished them right on the spot rather than giving them any great length of time. All they had was 70 years of empire, and then that's it, they were gone in one night. Next, he asks, my time of Torah Aricha Gnufte, how about the other way around? Why does an ox have a long tail? And he answers, Mishum the Dayer Ba'agmi, Rabbi Yehuda answers, because an ox lives and then feeds in the swamps. Oboy the Kaukushi Boki, he needs his tail to swat away the flies. Rashi says Boki means mosquitoes. So you have mosquitoes hang out in swamps over there. So he needs a long tail in order to brush them away. So Maharsha says now the ox represents the Malchus of the Jewish people. We find, for example, that Yosef is compared to an ox. So why is it that our that our downfall has been so long and has been was so gradual and so long. And the answer is because the little gnats over there are compared to the Averis. So in other words, Hashem, instead of punishing all the Averis at once, Hashem treats them like little gnats, dealing with them one at a time in order that we don't get wiped out. But therefore, because of that, because there's a lot of Averis that have to be cleaned up, therefore our downfall, therefore our tail, so to speak, has to be very long. Then he goes on to say, my time accounted to kamsa rakicha. Why is it that the antennas of a kamsa are soft? Rashi gives two explanations. One is that a kamsa is a locust, and the other is that it's an ant. So they have antennas on the front of their head. Why are those antennas soft? So the answer is sort of, Yehuda answers, Mishum the Daira Bechilfi, because this creature, whether it's a locust or whether it's an ant, lives among the tall grasses. The Ikasha, so if the antennas were stiff, Nadia, then they would break off from Isavra, and then the creature would go blind, because in fact its eyes are on the antennas. They're almost small. Haiman de Boy, the listening of a cancer. If a person wants to blind a cancer, Lishlofino Lakana, then he should pull off its antennas, and then it'll go blind because its antennas are what it sees and feels around with. By the way, in Rashi, you also have in parenthesis, you have another explanation. It's shablul, which means a snail, like we said before. And you have, in Chassidus, when it talks about kardein kamtzer l'gosh minei obey, that a kamtzer whose outer layer is part of itself, that seems to tackle refer more to a snail. So it could be that a kamtzer is a sort of a general term for various kinds of little creatures like that. Anyway. So the idea behind it, Maharsha says, is that we Jewish people in Golos are like these little weak creatures. Our koyach is only in our mouth, just like these creatures chew on things, and that's their koyach. A locust chews up all the greenery, and the same thing with each of these others, whether it's an ant or whether it's a snail or whatever. So therefore, that represents the one power that we have left, the power of tefillah. But even during Golos that Hashem made, we do have a certain degree of leadership. We do have, there were the Nesiim, there were the Rosh Golose, and later generations, there were other kinds of things like that where Jews had a certain amount of political power. But the point is that why is it soft? Why is it that that power is never really that strong? And the reason is because we live among the Goyim, or compared to grasses. And if that Malchus was too strong and powerful, then the Goyim would break it and crush it down. And therefore, Hashem, we'd go blind without leaders. So therefore, the Badavka, the leaders have to realize that they have to realize that the Goyim are in charge and act appropriately. Never give up Goyim Yisrael. You always have to be firm when it comes to standing up for Yiddishkeit, but not when it comes to standing up for other kinds of power and perquisites and what have you. Next, he asks, my time I timri the town of Goyla Madli La'eva. Why is it that a rooster's eyelid goes upward? Most creatures, people and most other creatures, when they close their eyelids, the bottom eyelid stays in place, more or less, and the top eyelid comes down to meet the bottom one. With a rooster, it's the other way around. The bottom eyelid moves upward to meet the top one. Why is that? Rav Zeira asks. So Rav Yehuda answers, "Didairi adape," because roosters perch up on high places, on beams or on other parts closer to the roof. Iokitra, if smoke were to get into their eyes, misavra, they would go blind. So instead, Hashem made it that instead their eyelid goes upward instead of downward. That way, in other words, it blocks the smoke which is coming upward, which is coming from the ground, but it blocks it from getting into their eye. Whereas if their eyelids went the other way around, it still could get in the space between the eyelids. As we're saying, a rooster, a male chicken.
No, the rooster is the big one.
No, roosters are just the males, hens are females. Yeah, we're talking chickens, but in general, yeah. Anyway, so what's the deeper idea behind it? Maharsha says is that the Jewish people can also be compared to a rooster. When we talk about that Hashem punishes the Jewish people a little here, a little there over the generations, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah compares it to the way a chicken pecks at things, a little here and a little there. And now you have when you're davening, the Gemara mentions in Yevamos a machlokes, what posture should your eyes be in when you're davening? Should you be looking upward to Shamayim, towards Hashem, so to speak, or should you be looking downward as to show that you're humbling yourself in front of Hashem? And the Gemara answers, and the Gemara explains over there that that Bisman Shebeis Hamikdash Kayam, you should be facing downward. Only when the Beis Hamikdash is not standing, then you should be facing a little bit upward. So we're saying, why is it that we Jewish people look upward? And the reason is because we're in Golos Chas V'Shalom, we're in danger of falling. We're in danger of falling off where we are. We need extra rachmim from Hashem, so therefore we look upward. And if it weren't for that, the smoke of the goyim who harass us would blind us. Chas V'Shalom.
Yeah, so when you're davening from a city, you're supposed to.
When you're davening from a city, you're looking to the city. Right. We're talking about in those days when they didn't daven from sidurim, or nowadays, even a person for whatever reason doesn't have a sidur. Yeah, it's true. If a person is davening from a sidur, of course you look down at the sidur. Yeah. Okay. So now the Gemara, so that was the series of questions that Reb Zeira asked Reb Yehuda. Now the Gemara further digresses, and maybe this is also part of the conversation between them, to talk about the meanings of various words. The idea, the Gemara is going to show how a lot of words in Aramaic are actually related to expressions in Lashon Kodesh. The idea being, one idea, the Maharal says on it, an idea in Chiddush HaGadus, that even though it's true that only we know that only Lashon Kodesh, every word in it is greatly significant and it has deep ruchniistic meanings. In most other languages, usually we say it's just why a certain word means a certain thing is just a convention that people came up with. Nevertheless, it's not just a convention that people stammed through letters together and made up something. It has a certain significance. It has a certain seichel behind it as well. So this is also an example, in other words, of that Hashem didn't create anything in the world for nothing, that even the Goyish languages, particularly Aramaic, because it's a language that has a certain degree of Kedusha as well, so there's deeper significance in the words in it. So the Gemara brings a bunch of examples. Dosha, the word in Aramaic for door, stands for Derech Sham, the way to there. This is, Marsha points out that, for example, if it was actually derived from Aramaic roots, then the word for Derech in Aramaic is Urcha. So then the word would be something like Urcham. The fact that it's called Dosha with the Dalet of Derech shows that it ultimately is descended from Lashon Kodesh. Similarly, Darga, a step, is called that because it's Derech Gag, it's the way to the roof. You go upstairs to go up to go to the roof. Maskulisa, a maskulisa, which Rashi explains as a sauce that you dip things in, is called that because emasayu mosai tichla da, when is this thing going to be used up? In other words, it's the kind of thing, you dip food in it and it takes a long time for a jar of it to be used up. So like people think like, when is it going to already be used up? Or Rashi says Rashi gives two explanations. The first one is that it's the kind of thing that sometimes it could be the last kind of food that a person might have around the house because it lasts so much longer than anything else. So people say to themselves, like once this is used up, what else are we going to have to eat? Masa tichla da, when this is gone, then we're in trouble. Or the second explanation is that masa tichla da, when would this be used up already? Because again, it goes very slowly because you only dip food in it. The Aruch brings another explanation of maskulisa. He says that it means a spindle that you spin thread on. Spinning thread is a very, very labor-intensive process. It takes a long time to do it. So you start the job and you're thinking to yourself, when is this going to already be done? It's a job that takes an awfully long time. Anyway, the next one, Besa, why is a house called that? Because it stands for Boi Va'esid Bahu, or Ba, come and we'll sit in it. Biksa, a hut, which means like a narrow, cramped kind of building, is called that because it stands for Kuf Batim, bend over and sit, because you're going to have to, I skipped one, Biksa Bei Aksa. The word Aksa means like very, very tight and narrow and crowded, so it means a very crowded house. That's why it's called Biksa. Next, Kufsa stands for Kuf Bativ. Kufsa stands for turn it over and sit on it. Rashi gives three explanations of what Kufsa is. The first one is it means a mortar, which you use to grind spices or other things like that. So it's a big, large container with a hollow, so you can turn it over and use it as a makeshift chair to sit on. The second one Rashi says is that it means it's a measuring container for wheat. Same idea, you can turn it over and sit on it. The third explanation Rashi says that kufsa is like a block of wood or something else that you could use to sit on. So again, like you put it down on the ground and you sit on it, and therefore it's called kufsa. Livni, next, bricks are called that because it stands for livnei bani, for children of children, because a brick building lasts a long time. chutzah. Why did a fence, a temporary fence made out of palm, made out of lulav leaves or other such things like that, or thorns, Rashi says, it's called that chatzitza, because it's like a temporary chatzitza, the hey and the tzaddik and then the ches, interchange, as they often do. And the point is, it's only like really a temporary chatzitza. It doesn't last for very long. Next, chatzva, a pail to get water from the river or from a well or whatever is called that. Shechoitzev mayim min ha-nahar, because you use it, so to speak, to carve water out of the river. You bring it into the river and put it in and fill up a bucket. It's like you carved the water out of where it was from. Kuza, a small earthenware container, is called kuza because it stands for kazeh, like this, like people say, like this, like it's next to nothing. Like, for example, one person might say to the other, Rashi says, give me a little bit kazeh, a little bit like this, of your wine as a present. And since it's a small amount, we would assume the other guy is not gonna mind. Marsha points out, it can also mean, for example, we sometimes talk about pachim tanim. We have, for example, famously Yaakov's pachim tanim. You want to know what they were like? Kazeh, they were like this little container here. Next, shutisa, a branch of hadas that they would use to dance with in front of a kala, is called that because shtusa, because when a person is dancing with it, he looks like a shoita. You have the famous story in Ksubas where Reb Shmuel Bar Yitzchak was dancing with hadasim in front of a kala, and then some of the other chachamim criticized, or Reb Zeira, I think it was, criticized him and said, you're acting in a foolish way. And then when he passed away, then a pillar of fire in the shape of a branch of hadas appeared by his levaya. And then Reb Zeira says, ahani l'shtusa l'sova, that the shtus that Reb Shmuel Bar Yitzchak was acting with, in fact, helped him out, and Taka and Hashem approved of it by showing that. So this is the famous thing of shtus tikdusha.
What happened? Dust was flying.
So by his levaya, they saw a pillar of fire came down that looked in the shape of a branch of habas. Everybody realized that it was in the source of how he'd been Sameach Chos in the Pala all those years. So you have three different versions in the Gemara of what Reb Zeira said. Is it that it's the shutise, his bundle of hadas, helped him, or shtuse, his way of acting that seemed on the face of it to be like shoita, or you have a third one over there that I don't remember, but whatever. You have three different versions of what Reb Zeira said, all amounting to the point, in other words, that Hashem showed with that pillar of fire that he approves of what Reb Shmuel Bar Yitzchak was doing, that it, because it was a great mitzvah to be Sameach Chos in the Kala. Shitose Vasava is shita of acting in this way, with the third one here. Okay. Next, the Gemara continues. Mishikla, a basin that people use for washing themselves, is called that because it stands for mashikula, washing everybody. Mashi is an Aramaic word meaning to wash. Mashiklasa. Then you have, on the other hand, a smaller basin, which is not a smaller and fancier basin, which only important people use to wash themselves. So that's that called that because it stands for mashiakalsa, washing the kala. Like only a kala or another important woman would use a small one like that. The next one, asisa, an asisa, which is again a mortar, one of these large containers that you use to grind up spices or whatever in, is called that because chasirta, there's something missing from it. How do you make a mortar? One way of doing it, you take a block of wood, for example, and you carve out the inside to make a hollow, and then you have a mortar. So therefore, it's missing something from the original block. The Aruch brings a different explanation, a different girsa, and a different explanation. The word is not chasirta, but chasidta with a dalid, and therefore it means the same way as a mortar is constantly, so to speak, tolerating, you're constantly banging on it with the pestle to grind up spices or whatever it is you're doing in it, the same way a chasid, it's like a chasid, so to speak, where you keep on insulting him and doing whatever to him, and he still takes it all in stride. He still takes it all with ava to the Eishna. So a mortar is like a chosid in that sense. Next, we have the other piece that goes with the mortar. It's called buchna, the pestle, the piece of wood or whatever it is that you use to bang on the spices, to grind them up. Why is it called buchna? It stands for boiva akena, come and I'm going to beat it. Next, levusha, a garment, particularly Rashi says levusha means a person's outer garment, is called that because loy busha, it prevents the person from being embarrassed. Like this, you have his underclothing might have holes and stains and whatever, and rips and whatever in it, and then you cover it over with good-looking clothing, and therefore nobody knows what's underneath. glimmer. Then you have a glimmer, which is like a wrap or a cloak that a person wraps themselves in. It's called that chenasa b'kegolam, because when a person is wearing that, then he looks like a golam, in the sense that golam means an unformed object. So it means when a person is wrapped in that, you can't see his arms or anything that looks like one big looks like just one big mass. So therefore, in that sense, it looks like a like an unfinished object, like a golem. Marsha brings from the Aruch another explanation. When a person is sitting over there wrapped in a glimmer, he looks like he can't do anything. So he looks like a golem in the other sense, like a golem as in the sense of a person who can't do anything useful. Next. Gulsa, then you have on top of that, a person might wear a gulsa, which is a nice kind of coat, or like a papata or something. That is called that because it stands for gali v'esiv, uncover and let me sit down. So Rashi explains when you want to sit down, when you're wearing a gulsa and you want to sit down, you don't just sit down directly on it, because then it's a nice thing, it'll get worn out in the seat or whatever. So rather you pick up the edges of it and then you sit down like you do sometimes when you're wearing a kapata, and therefore it's called gulsa. Next, Puria. Why is a bed called Puria in Aramaic? The reason is Shaparin Varov and Aleph, because you do Puria Varivya on it. Burzinka, a pit that dried up, a water pit where the water in it dried up and there's no more water available. Why is it called Burzinka? Because it stands for Burzenaki. This bur is clean. It's cleaned out of all the water in it. Sudra, then you have a person wears a Talmid Chacham wears a sudra on his head, which is something like a turban. Why is it called that? Because it stands for Soid Hashem Liyreyav, the secrets of Hashem, or for those who fear him, meaning that Hashem gives over the secrets of Torah, and sometimes you find it in the Gemara, the secrets of how things work in the natural world, to the Talmid Chacham who learned Torah with Ava and Yira to the Eveshteh, and therefore it's called sudra. And another one, a padna, a fancy mansion, or actually Rashi says it means a palace, is called that. It's called a padna because it stands for a pishadein, to this door, because this is the kind of place everybody is always coming to the door of the palace, whether it's because they're coming because they need the king to judge them, or whether it's because they have to serve the king. So people are always coming there, and therefore it's called a padna, short for a pishadein. Okay. We mentioned before the powerful creatures, the various powerful creatures that Hashem made, that still Hashem created a weak creature for each one of them to scare it. So going back to that point, the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Shloisha calls Manshamaskin in Maisif and Gura. There are three kinds of creatures that the older they get, the stronger they get. The Elohim, dog, the Nachash, the Chazir, a fish, a snake, and a Chazir. Why after those three? The Maharal says an interesting idea. He says most creatures are sort of like somewhere in between. A person, for example, in particular, is composed of many different elements and things. But most creatures also are they're a mixture of different elements, and eventually those elements come apart, and therefore the creature weakens and dies. But he says a fish is created from the water, so therefore it's like more into one extreme. The snake is associated with fire and with heat, and therefore it's to the other extreme. The chazir, the Gemara tells us in Kiddushin, has most of the measures of tsaras in the world, so therefore it's to that extreme. So each of them being at the extreme of something in the world, then therefore on the contrary, as they get older, they become stronger. Further on, the Gemara talks about, again, we're still talking about various substances. If a person carries them out on Shabbos, how much is he chayev for carrying? So first it says that if a person is carrying out blood, then the amount would be a revius or a gregeris or whatever. And then the Gemara says, Rav Shimon Elazar Omer, dom kedelikchol ayin achas. Actually, when a person carries out blood on Shabbos, it depends. Sometimes he may be chayev, even if he takes out a smaller amount, the amount that you could use to paint one eye. Shekein kothlan lebarkis, because when a person is suffering from barkis, which is some kind of eye disease, Rashi translates it as a cataract, then you put a certain kind of blood on it, and it helps cure it. The Gemara says, mind you, specifically what kind of blood do you use? Dumb at a town of Gota Bora, you use the blood of a wild hen, which means particularly, we mean particularly uh, the uh, Rashi elsewhere explains that it's what the Torah calls duchi fas. In English, it's called a hoopoe. It's a type of bird. It's one listed among the non-kosher birds, but it's in Gittin, you have the famous story with Ashmedai over there, and it mentions how that creature uses the shamir worm to split open mountains. So you take blood from that, and that's good for this barkas. So then if a person carries out that amount of blood from a town of Gobara on Shabbos, then he would be chayev, Rav Shimon Elazar says, because that's a useful amount. Similarly, Rav Shimon Gamliel also says that there can be a kind of blood where a person is chayev for carrying enough to paint one eye. Shekein kochel on the yorud, because there's a type of blood that you paint on the eye in order to cure yorud. Rashi gives two explanations of yorud. One is that it's tvalu, which we find in Parshas Emor among the mumim of Koyanim, where the white and the black parts of the eye are mixed up. There's some kind of growth that extends from one into the other. So like instead of each one being sharply defined, they're mixed up. Rashi's second explanation is that it's white spots. It's called chavarvur in the Gemara, white spots that appear in the eye. So whatever it is, the Tosfos brings a proof for that second one. Anyway, the point is, when a person is suffering from those, then you put some kind of blood on the eye and it helps cure it.
There's a line connecting black part of the eye with the white part of the
eye. Right, so something like that is an example of a tvalu, yeah. Yeah. So remind you, what kind of blood do you use for that? Dama de Krushtina. For that, you use the blood of a Krushtina. Now, Rashi says that means an atalef, which is a bat, but the French word that Rashi uses actually means a mole. The bat and the mole do look somewhat alike, so maybe it actually means you could use one or the other, or maybe he means a bat which resembles a mole or whatever. The Aruch brings a different explanation, and Ben Hanano here on the Gemara brings also a different explanation that it means a domestic chicken, as opposed to the wild hen that we said before. For the other kind, in this one you would use a domestic one. The simonach, and the way to remember which is which, gava legava, the one that's on the outside is used, the one that's on the inside is used for what's on the inside, namely the krushtina, whether it's a bat or a mole or a chicken or whatever it is, lives in settled areas, inside, so to speak, in the city or whatever. Therefore, you use it for something that's inside the eye, which is whether yorur is a tvalul or whether it's a chavarvur, it's something inside the eye rather than on top of it. So therefore, the simon is you use something that lives inside human settlements to cure an internal eye problem. Ubara labara, and the one on the outside, the duchifas, which lives out in the middle of nowhere, that you use that for something that's on the outside of the eye, the cataract. This is, by the way, another example. Mustami brought it in Yaakov over here, because this is another example of Lloyd Bara Javarach of the Batala. You're going to wonder what the purpose of bats or moles or what have you. Now you have an answer. They're good for these kinds of things. Yom Yom Mashiach Gula, Hey Year, 20th day of the Omer. The main point in every Yid's life has to be, as we say in the Haggadah, Kol Yom Echayach Alohavim Yemoisa Mashiach, which means that a person's chayus every moment has to be in bringing Yemoisa Mashiach, and that will automatically put a person in a point of view and a standpoint of Yemoisa Mashiach. And why do we say Yemoisa Mashiach in the plural? Because you have the two general periods in Yemoisa Mashiach. It also represents all the various great levels from going from one level to the other that we're going to have in Yemoisa Mashiach. Halacha, still talking about Shechiyonu and Atov Vahmetiv. If you buy things that are going to be used by yourself and the whole family, then you say Atov Vahmetiv. And again, like we said yesterday, the Alter Rebbe says that really, even if you buy gold or silver kalim or whatever, the minhag is not to make a Shechiyonu on those at all. So maybe this halacha would apply. Let's say like a person buys a new car or something and he and his family are going to be using it. Maybe then he would say, Atov Vahmetiv, even that, I don't know.